Okay. As I was saying before, this is a topical issue, unfortunately. Although I'm not really interested in talking right now about exact current events and, you know, people running around and harming other people in the way that they've been in the last few days. And I'm not really talking about how to deal with that emotionally, psychologically, religiously, hashgafically, halachically. That's an important discussion, and I don't really want to have that right now, although that could kind of be part of the discussion, because I think there is a lot to be said about an appropriate response when people are trying to terrorize. What is the, how to deal with fear? This is true in America, as much as, it's true everywhere, because terror is something which is not local to this area, unfortunately. It's all over the world. And therefore, how to deal with fear in a way that actually defeats the terrorism by not becoming terrorized, that's an important discussion. And it's also a halakhic discussion, because the Torah itself discusses, to the in the sense of going into war, chayalim, at the end of Parsha Shoftim, it talks about how to deal with the natural fear that people, you feel when someone's attacking you, overcome that fear, turn it into courage, and then be able to beat an enemy. And that's what we have to do. Everyone is a chayal now. Everyone is a soldier in the world. The battle front has come right to people's front doors. And that's how it is now. Asymmetrical warfare, or non-conventional warfare, whatever they call it, this is the way. It's not fought on a battlefield far away while you just get news. Everyone's looking at news everywhere. And by the way, that's part, in my humble opinion, of the source of anxiety, is obsessive news watching. It's not helpful. It's not necessary. It doesn't keep you safe. It actually makes you more anxious. And therefore, just occasional, just keeping abreast of what's going on so that you have an understanding, you're able to have an opinion, and where necessary, take action that you need in order to help yourself or protect yourself. That's important. But the kind of, can you imagine the Second World War having been fought on, you know, while Facebook, where everyone was following every single operation on Facebook, and every soldier was Facebooking home, and every single thing, you know, there's a point at which it actually undermines the ability to actually beat something. And therefore, I think it's important for you to not allow yourselves to become anxious in that way. But that's not what I'm talking about today. Excuse me. I'm really talking about how we deal with the inevitability, especially today, of killing civilians as part of a war effort. And one of the difficulties here is, where do we look for answers to that? We don't have a Shulchan Aruch that was written for a national scenario. Meaning, when the Shulchan Aruch, when the halakhic systems that we used to were written, we were an oppressed minority. We weren't fighting wars. We weren't dealing with other people. We certainly weren't killing anybody as part of a war effort. Therefore, where am I going to look for these halakhot? We need to talk about that. And it's also, this is kind of an oral law question, like we were talking about before. We have a built-in frustration that we don't even have a fully functioning halakhic system to deal with this. Meaning, when we had a country, back when we had a country, we also had a Sanhedrin. We also had a system whereby we could come up with halakhic solutions to national problems. This, for us, is a source of pain and frustration. And when you daven, she'ibane beis hamikdash b'mheiru v'yameinu, you want a beis hamikdash. It's not just because you want a building, we can all go there on Yom Tov and, you know, and have a great time. The next three words are, v'tein chalkeinu b'toratecha, and give us, then, a place in your Torah. So, you might say, well, I don't need a beis hamikdash to have a chelek in Torah. I have Torah now. That's the one thing we do have. The answer is no. We have the Torah that we've had for the last 1700 years in Galut or whatever. We don't have the Torah yet again, which was designed for our national situation, which we need. And therefore, some of the frustrations that we feel halakhically in dealing with problems which are national, like conversion, Geirut, which is a big issue, to what extent should we be more inclusive and bring in lots of people who are immigrants who are questionably halakhically Jewish and make them halakhically Jewish? And to what extent is that watering down and unacceptable? To what extent, how can we deal with aguna and modern day issues of people who refuse to give their wives a get? These societal issues could be dealt with differently if we had the tools to be able to do that with a Sanhedrin, and we daven for that, and we hope for that, and therefore that's part of our frustration of not yet having a Geula situation. There are no neat solutions to this question. It's about civilian casualties. How do you measure those against military goals? To what extent should soldiers risk their lives rather than kill civilians from the other side? To what extent should soldiers risk their lives rather than have our side civilians killed? How do you balance civilians versus soldiers? One of the issues in Israel is we're so obsessive about our soldiers. Rightly so. Everyone is like a national, like everyone's grandchild. To what extent do we actually endanger the lives of civilians, our own civilians, because we don't want to harm soldiers? We had this debate with the Gilad Shalit debacle, where everyone was so obsessed to get Gilad Shalit back, we had to pay an enormous price to do that, which may be today endangering the lives of the civilians of the country. Is that right? Is that wrong? I'm not here to give you political opinions, by the way. You're not interested in hearing my political opinions. Or if you are, then we can talk another time. I'm not here to give you military solutions. I'm not a military person. But these questions come up, and people have to really think about them. To what extent should we even kill our own soldiers to avoid a bigger problem? You may seem like a strange question, but my grandfather, Alav Shalom, was in the Second World War. He fought in the British Army. He said when they were on the beaches of Dunkirk, they evacuated the British Army from Dunkirk. It was a military fiasco. There were hundreds of thousands of British soldiers holed up on the beach in Dunkirk because they'd been beaten basically by the Germans at the beginning of the Second World War. The Germans were kind of bombing them, strafing them with machine gun fire. My grandfather, they're all lining up on the beach waiting for these little ships to come in to pick them up and take them back to England. And I'm talking about little ships, people on rowing boats kind of coming across the English Channel to try and pick up like 10 at a time. It's unbelievable. So my grandfather says they were lined up on the beach with the Germans machine gunning them, and they had to keep order. If there would have been a panic, there would have been mass carnage. So he said the British officers told the British soldiers to stand in line, and any British soldier that broke out of the line because they were scared or there were Germans, he shot him in the head. So the British officers were shooting down British soldiers to keep order. Is that the right thing to do? Is that the wrong thing to do? Can you do that? At what point do you refuse to follow an order because you say it's unethical? I was only following orders, we saw from Nuremberg, was not an acceptable defense. On the other hand, a soldier can't be there to kind of debate whether something's moral or immoral. This is one of the issues, having front soldiers in the army. It's very nice having so many beautiful front soldiers in the army. My son's in a unit now where there's a large number of people, the officers, the kids, the front, and then the religious army. Fine, but when the officer in charge, in chief, whatever, gives a command, and someone says, well, hang on a minute, he's going to ask a Shiloh about that one, picks up the phone and phones up their RAV, and says, can I do this, can I not? You can't run an army like that. You can't run an army where every soldier is an officer. They have to do what they're told, but then there has to be an appointment to say, I'm not going to do this, it's wrong. And therefore, these are questions that we have to ask. And we're not going to get neat answers. Yes?
In that situation, shouldn't the commanding officer be someone who's already consulted or off, so that the command themselves?
Commanding officer may not be religious. That's commanding officer may not be interested. Maybe. On the other hand, who should be making the decisions? Rabbanim or the soldiers? Or both together. So let's have a look at some sources. For the next 45 minutes, I'm going to show you a range of different sources that deal with this issue. I'm not going to come into any firm conclusions, but I wanted to show you where we look when we're trying to deal with this. First of all, there's a beautiful midrash that deals with war and peace. Meaning, sometimes you have to kill people, and sometimes you have to kill civilians. That's the nature of reality. For all of human history, we've had to, in the right, people who are the good guys, whoever they are, have had to kill people in order to defend their way of life. That's just the way it always has been, and the way it will be until, you know, human nature changes, Mashiach comes, etc. So when Golda Meir turned around and gave that famous quote saying, we can forgive the Arabs for killing our sons, but we can't forgive the Arabs for turning our sons into killers, with the greatest respect for Golda Meir, I think she's completely wrong. The idea that you've turned our sons into killers, in the sense that something, you know, that you've degraded them in some way. Well, one second. Part of being a human being has to be able to kill where necessary. That, unfortunately, is part of life. in order to kill the person, whether you have to do that, there has to be the strength of mind to do that. It's not that you become a murderer. There's a difference between murder and legitimate killing. Even though we might not want it, and we certainly don't want it, and we'll see soon a source that shows that very clearly, I think it's important that we understand that we have to kill people, but we've thought it through. Meaning, what we have at the moment facing us is a lot of anger, rage. Every day is a new day of rage. Yeah? You know, the gates of hell and rage and anger and people responding in very sort of animalistic ways. The way to respond to that is with the opposite, which is not love, compassion, and, you know, brotherly human kindness. That might not be the appropriate thing, but the way to respond to it is a response which is not rage, which is not anger, which is thought through, which is discussed, which is ethically analysed, and then implemented. Okay? There is a role for compassion, but we'll see what that is. It's a compassion which is not soft, it's a hard compassion. But we'll see how that comes out. Okay, number one, the beautiful medrash. The Zot Torat Zevach HaShlamim. Talks about the korban called the Shlamim. What does the word Shalom mean? Oh, so why is the korban called the Shlamim? So look. Zeh Shekotzev Darcheha Darchei Noam. I call the Sifo Secha Shalom. It says in the Psukim in Mishlei that all the ways of the Torah are peace. What does that mean? Says the Medrash here as follows: Kol Mashe B'Torah L'Shum Shalom Hu Nichtav. Everything in the Torah is written for the goal of peace. Even though the Torah says sometimes we have to fight and kill in wars, even the wars are for the sake of peace. We have to fight wars for the sake of peace. Even God, says the Midrash, reversed his command because of peace. And look at what it says. When did this happen? When God was giving the laws of war in Sefer Dvarim to Moshe Rabbeinu, look at what happened. Amalei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God says to Moshe, Sheyachrim Otam. He has to wipe out the enemy. The seven nations, the Canaanite nations, to wipe them out. Kill them all completely. Shneimar, it says, Ki Achrim Tacharim Em. You have to kill them all out. Moshe lo asakei, but Moshe didn't do that. He refused to do what God says. Ela Amar, he said, Achshav ani holech umakam mishechata umishelochata. How can I kill someone who sinned with someone who didn't? How can I kill the innocent together with the guilty? I'm not going to kill everybody. Amazing. What do you expect God to respond to this? Moshe says, I can't do that. Ela, but Moshe says, I'm going to initiate my own idea. I'm going to open up with peace. And Moshe says, he sends messengers. Okay, divrei shalom, I sent peace messengers to the kings of the nations there. I want to pass through your land. So Moshe changes it to peace. Since he saw that they weren't coming back at him with peace, they were coming back at him with armies, he can't and he killed them. He has to kill them. He's not going to stand there and be killed. Shenema, as it says, v'yakuoto ve'et banav ve'et kolamo. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem responds to this and says, Ani amarti ki achrim tachrim. I told you to kill everybody. Va'ata lo asita kenon. You decided not to do that. Chayecha, by your life, k'shem she'amarta kach. If that's what you want, Ani yoseh. I'm going to say that too. Says God to Moshe, you're right. And a new mitzvah gets put in the Torah, Shenemar, when you come close to a city to make war with it, says God, you must first offer a peace. Amazing. That's why it says that God, as it were, midrashically, is even prepared to change the Torah because Moshe says, I'm not prepared to kill innocent civilians if I don't have to. I'm just not. And God says, you know, you're right, let's make it so that you have to open with peace. Now, leaving aside the philosophical questions as to, you know, who's writing the Torah, Moshe or God, and what does this mean? I'm not getting into that. You see what the Midrash is trying to get at, which is that whatever we do, wherever we have to go, and whatever when we have to kill people, which we have to do, it has to be l'shem shalom, whatever that means. I think it's very appropriate that the Israeli Defense Forces are called exactly that. It's not the Israeli army. It's with the defense forces. We are here only to defend the country. We're not interested in attacking anybody. No, you might turn around and say, well, that's all rhetoric. And, okay, I'm not getting into politics. I'm not saying that everything the Israeli army ever did was perfect. Not saying that at all. But I'm saying in principle, the idea is that it should be a defensive, peace-oriented war, and that's going to change the way we do certain things in the war. And who decides that, we'll have to talk about. Now, where am I going to look for halakha on this? So this is a very interesting question. As I said to you, it's not so easy to open up the Shulchan Aruch and look at the halakhas of how to and how not to kill civilians. They're not going to be there so easily. You can look at the Rambam. I mean, there are other things you can look at. You can look at individual issues, for example, and we'll see in a minute. There's a halakha called Roideh. What is Roideh? A pursuer. Meaning, this is in Shulchan Aruch, obviously. If I see somebody pursuing someone else to kill them, or to harm them, we'll see how, I'm allowed to kill the Roideh in order to prevent them from murdering someone else. There's also a halacha called Hababa Machteret, a different halacha, which is a mitzvah in the Torah, which is if somebody breaks into a house in the middle of the night, and the homeowner finds them, the homeowner it says in the Torah, if the homeowner thinks it's possible that they may be willing to use lethal force, people has broken in, he's allowed to kill them, and he's not guilty of murder. Mm-hmm. Unless it's absolutely clear, says the Torah, that the guy is not interested in using lethal force, in which case you cannot kill him, but unless it's clear, then you can defend yourself by preemptively killing the other guy because he's broken into your house. The question is, can you take the laws of Roideh and Hababa Machteret and just magnify them and apply them on a national level? Are we facing hundreds or thousands of roidim? Is that what we're dealing with when we're dealing with Palestinian terror on the streets? Is it lots of individuals attacking us? Or is it something different? Is it a national struggle? Is it a nation against a nation? And how does that change anything? And part of the problem we have right now is defining, everyone has this asymmetrical warfare. It's defining who is who. It's much easier in 1973, Syria attacks Israel. Israel retaliates against Syria, whatever it is, and this one wins and this one loses. It's not how wars work anymore. Now it's civilians and an army all mixed together and nobody's wearing uniforms and they kind of blend in and you never know whether the people you're fighting are just civilians who've gone mad or actual trained fighters from an army. How do you know? And how do you respond? So this is a difficulty that everybody's facing. Of course we see this part of the difficulty of discussing this is that at the same time there's a lot of emotional stuff going on right now and also there's just such crass hypocrisy of the highest order and maybe one of the good things that can come out of some of the things going on now is at least some more people will wake up to the ridiculous hypocrisy that's going on. And I also don't feel, of course I would say that because I'm Israeli, yada yada, but I think that the way people turn a blind eye to all sorts of nations doing all sorts of things all the time, and yet certain things get focused on us, it's on the one hand it's very, you know, it's very, what's the word? It's a big compliment that so much is expected of us and no one on everyone else. On the other hand, it's disgraceful, so that makes it harder. But where am I going to put the Shulchan Aruch? Am I going to look in the Rambam, just before I turn over the page? The Rambam deals with the halachas of war more. Am I going to go further afield? Maybe I have to look for the laws of in Tanakh. Meaning, can I use stories from Tanakh to teach me how to fight a war? There's all sorts of stories in Tanakh of how Jewish realm is fought. They're not in the Shulchan Aruch, but they are in Tanakh. And is that good enough? Can I translate that into halacha? Can I go even further? Can I look at the Maccabim? Sefer HaMakabim, and Josephus, and how the Jews fought the wars against the... Can these be used? Meaning, we've had lots of Jewish armies in the history, and they fought lots of wars. Can I learn from those as sources as well? Is that legitimate or is that not legitimate? Maybe there are no halachas of war. Maybe it's like Dina de Malchus Adina. What does Dina de Malchus Adina mean? The law of the land is the law, meaning, on a completely different issue, what are the halachas of driving regulations? What speed am I allowed to drive according to halacha? The answer is, I live in a country, they have rules, there's a system of highway, you know, code, whatever. So whatever it says, if it's a 40 zone, it's a 40 zone, if it's a 70, it's a 70. There's no halachic system that overrides that. The law of the land is the law. Maybe here too, the law of the world on how to fight a war is how we have to fight a war. Is there such a thing? Does the world have laws on how to fight wars? Sure. The Geneva Convention, which you wrote, which is interesting because the means that the Geneva Convention is more observed in the breach than the observance. And that's also going to be an interesting question. If there's a law of the land which everybody breaks and everybody just tramples on, then can they expect me to keep that law if nobody else keeps that law? And that's going to be true of the Geneva Convention as well. How can you have every country in the world that wants to just trample on it, just trample, not every country in the world, but certain big bully countries trample all over the Geneva Convention, and nobody says boo because nobody can, and then, you know, all of a sudden it's held up to us. Just out of interest, and we're not going to have time to deal with this now, on page 10 at the back in the appendix, I brought you the additional protocol to the Fourth Geneva Convention, which deals with civilian deaths as collateral damage in warfare. And if you want to look at that in your own time, you'll see, especially in subclause 5, how that deals with the matter of civilians. And it's very clear under the Geneva Convention that there are circumstances in which it is legally legitimate to kill civilians as part of a military strike. There is no question about that at all. The question is how to interpret and how to apply, etc. So maybe the Dina de Malchus Adina. We have to work out how where our sources are going to be. And of course, there is always the view that no Jewish war is allowed. The whole state is not allowed. We should all be waiting for Mashiach and everything is also. That's all very well, except it doesn't make it much easier to make a decision tomorrow as to how to fight a war. But there is that position, the Satmar position, etc., that the whole thing shouldn't be halakhically valid anyway. Yes, sir.
Whether it's said that we should fight a war or we shouldn't fight a war, there's still like implications that happen. There was a soldier, you know, within the last week or two, someone who shot one of the terrorists and went to throw a guilt thing because he's Kohen.
Right.
And said, like, am I allowed to guilt thing?
Right.
I have blood on him.
Right.
You're in the act of war.
Right.
You're, you know, killed before you're killed.
So the Shiloh there, right, exactly. The Shiloh there is in a normal army situation. There's no question the Kohenim, when they're fighting in a milchemic mitzvah, which we'll see, is a war you're allowed to fight and obligated to fight. There's no question of the duchening issue. The question is here, these are civilians on the street, and they're running with this or that, and therefore, you know, I believe if asking, he is allowed to duchen, absolutely. And we'll see where that's coming from. I'm not going to go through every source on the sheet. I want to show you what's on the sheet and what it basically says. First of all, a couple of words on Roidef and Ababa Machter. Over to page 2. What is the sense of proportionality? Which is interesting. People are always using talking about proportionate response. How does that work? Is it a numbers game? Can I kill 10 people to save 20? Can I kill 20 people to save 10? Or is that not relevant anymore? Is there any sense of the need to be proportionate? On the one hand, there obviously some need to be proportionate. Can I kill an entire country of people if one of our people is in danger? Clearly, I don't think anybody would suggest that. But on the other hand, so where do you draw that line? And of course, this is very relevant. You know, there's a building somewhere in Gaza with 800 people living in it, most of them civilians, okay? And there's a guy with a rocket launcher coming out of there with a rocket launch towards a city in Israel. The rocket hits the city. Who knows what damage it could do and who it could kill? Can you take the whole building down to stop that rocket? That rocket might just fall on the open ground. You don't know. But you don't know. So can you do that? That's the kind of decisions that are being made. And by the way, that happens to... What's that?
We do that all the time. Like, you know, anything to get us on
the line. Oh, yeah. There are strikes by America and Russia all the time in the Middle East at the moment against ISIS, against this one, against that one. Nobody is reporting. Nobody is interested. Nobody could care less about civilian casualties. They really can't. They're not. Do you ever see it on the news? Does anyone know? Can you believe that these strikes are being carried out with the precision that the only people being hurt or injured are going to be the people who are guilty? That's beyond belief. The answer is nobody's interested. There are people in ISIS at the moment in Syria who are beheading Palestinians. Beheading them in refugee camps in Syria. Is that making the news? I thought everybody's very upset about the Palestinians. Evidently, selectively. Because never, unfortunately, people are innocent, are being killed, and nobody's reporting on it. So you're right. The hypocrisy is astounding. But that doesn't take away the moral question. If the Americans are doing it, if the Russians are doing it, should we do it? Maybe we can do it. I'm not going to say yes or no, but I'm going to show you where to look. First of all, in Roida, it's very clear that there is a law of proportionality. The halacha brought down in the Rambam, first of all, the mission number two, the following people can be killed rather than allow them to carry out the crime. If someone's chasing another person to kill them, or someone is chasing after a man or a woman, a married woman, to rape them. Which is interesting, because rape, even though it's not lethal, also justifies lethal response to stop the rapist. Which is interesting. So the question is, if she's unmarried, is there any danger to life? For sure, yes. No question about it. And the question is where rape fits in. Meaning, there is rape which is rape plus also a capital crime, and there's rape which is the violent crime of rape. For example, if somebody is running at somebody to injure them, but not to kill them, I can't kill them, stop the injury. The question is, where does rape fall on the range of crimes between injury and death? And it's somewhere in between, and the question is, and there are different kinds of rape. In English or in American law, there's aggravated rape, there's different kinds of rape. The rape is not one thing. There are multiple types of rape in different scenarios, and that reflects the different sentencing that you see for rape crime all over the world. And that's just reflected in halacha. What I'm interested in here is, when I go for this guy to take him down to stop him from killing, do I have to try and use other means before I kill him? And here the Rambam is very explicit, and the halacha is explicit. Look at number three in the underline. Im yicholim lahatzilo, if you can save the victim, be'eva me'ivari harodif, by taking out a limb of the rodif, by shooting him in the leg. People ask questions like this. Should you try and shoot people in the legs to try and take them down? Leaving aside whether that's militarily realistic or not, can you aim for people's legs? Legs are quite small. Or do you have to aim for the trunk of the person? So says the Rambam, with a rodif, if you can take them out some other way, kagon shiyaka oto b'chet, you fire an arrow at them somehow, or be'evin, or a stone, or b'saif, or a sword, b'kta'it yodov, you took off their hand, or shishabu et ragov, or you break their foot, or you sam et enov, or you blind them to stop them, yes. You have to do that. You have to do that. Meaning with roidev, you have to try a lower level of intervention if it works. And only if it doesn't work are you allowed to kill the person, which is interesting. So if the halachas of how we deal with terrorists are based on roidev, do we have to be trying to lower level hurt them before killing them, or can we just kill them? Which will work? Clearly, he says, if it's not going to work to just try and shoot them in the leg, you can kill them. You can kill the rodif. And by the way, that's even if the rodif is not guilty. How so? There are cases where there's something called a rodif, which is damaging or threatening another person, even when the rodif themselves is unaware of it. Two cases. The case of the classic case of the hunter in the forest aiming his rifle at a piece of at an animal, but by mistake he didn't realize he's aiming it at a person. There's some stupid guy out in the forest with a stag, you know, antlers on a stag night or whatever, and dancing out in the forest, and you are watching this and you see this hunter about to shoot the guy completely innocently. You can shoot the hunter because he's about to kill an innocent person. Or what about a baby? An unborn child unwittingly threatening the life of the mother is in halacha called a roida. You have a mother and you have an unborn baby who is threatening to kill the mother, even though the baby's not has no criminal intent, have no intent at all. Nevertheless, the baby's a roida and the baby can be killed to save the life of the mother. Now, there's more to abortion than that, but that's part of it. Yes?
With
good. So that's discussed in the sources as well. If you need to save someone's life, and you can either do it by killing someone or by torturing somebody, which is better? So that's an interesting question. You can debate whether it is a lower level to kill someone or a lower level to torture somebody. I don't know what the answer to that is. I've seen it written, and it seems to make sense that torturing someone who survives is less intervention than killing them outright when they're dead afterwards. On the other hand, some people may turn around and say they'd rather be killed than be tortured. I don't know. That's not something I can really comment on. But that is part of the discussion. And there are long essays. And by the way, I brought you at the end of the sheet, not quite the end, on page 9, I brought you a reading list. If you're interested in this topic, here's a reading list of about 15 different articles and books, many of which are available free online, and which reflects a range of opinions on these issues, which you can look at more. When you finish that, you can come to me and I'll give you some more. There are literally hundreds of articles. Hundreds of articles on this, because this is an issue which people have to face. Let's talk about Tanakh. Interestingly, in our Baba Machteret, before we talk about Tanakh, the issue of someone breaking into your house, the Rambam doesn't mention any proportionality. He says if someone stands up and you have any reason to believe they're going to kill you, unless you're absolutely sure they're not going to use force, you're allowed to kill them. What the difference is between Roideh and the Baba Machteret is too complicated for now, and I'm not getting into it. I've brought some sources. You can look them up in the footnotes. What about Tanakh? Where can we find situations in Tanakh of civilians being killed in the process of a military operation? The answer is lots. Lots as in a lot, rather than Lot, the character in Tanakh. I didn't mean Lot. It gets a bit confusing. First of all, Yaakov the 8 and the 400 men. You know the story? Yaakov, Parshas Vayishlach, is coming back from Israel with his family, and up rolls Esav. He gets a message. Esav's coming with 400 men. So obviously this makes Yaakov somewhat nervous. Look at the Pasuk number 6. Vayira Yaakov, ma'od. He was very scared. Vayetzalo. And he was very upset. Very frightened. So why is he scared and frightened? Very classic Rashi, famous Rashi. Rashi says at the end number 6, Vayira, he was scared, Shema Yerek, maybe he'll get killed. Vayetzaloi, and he was scared, Im Yarog Hu et Acherim, maybe he'll have to kill others. He doesn't want to have to kill others. So all the Mephoshim are asking, I understand he's scared, he doesn't want to get killed. But what's his problem with killing other people? These are 400 big, hairy, nasty men coming to kill him. What's his problem killing them? Isn't that called self-defense? They're Roifim, it's a Baba Machteret, they're coming up to kill him. He can kill them. Why is he scared? So some people want to say, no, that's the whole point. He knows he can kill them, but he just doesn't like the idea. What's that? Oh, so some of the Mephoshim suggest, how do you know all these 400 people are really drafted to kill him? How does he know? He doesn't really know their intent. Maybe Asaph's pulled in a whole crowd, you know, a mob. He's picked up at the local pub and said, chase me, you know, come with me. And Yaakov doesn't know who he's killing. Maybe he's killing the wrong ones. Maybe he's killing the right ones. He's scared. The Maharal says that. He doesn't know who the people are. Others say, no, that's not why he's scared. Of course he can kill them. The point is he's scared that he's going to kill Asaph. And his father's going to get upset. He doesn't want to upset his father. Because his father before Asaph is Yitzhak's son. So there is one story. Then the main one that we need to look at is Shimon and Levi. You know the story of Shimon and Levi? Yes.
I was just wondering, if he's scared he's going to kill Esav. Esav is the root of all of the evil.
Yeah, but it's his father's son.
Right, but then aren't all human beings the children of Hashem? And therefore,
I understand, but they're not usually the children of your parents.
Right, but Hashem is our parent.
Oh, okay, I understand that. But it's different when it's family, you know? Family is family. No, Hashem is our father, but our father is our closer father. You know? People are usually more worried about upsetting their own parents than upsetting God. Actually, not always. It depends on their relationship with their parents. I don't want to get into psychology of whether people are closer to God or to their parents. But Shimon and Levi is a much more interesting topic right here. Because Shimon and Levi, remember the story? What's the story? Dina wanders out looking for action. See what's going on with the local Canaanites. That's what it says. It says, Tata Dina, she goes out. And of course, what happens to her? She gets kidnapped. She gets raped. Okay? And Shimon and Levi are outraged. And therefore, they cook up this whole scheme. And they go to Shechem. And they say to them, how can you take in our sister? Listen, we can't marry her to you because you're not circumcised. If you all circumcise yourselves, you can be one big happy clan with us. And we'll all do it together, and you can keep Dina, and your daughters will go to us, and our daughters will go to you, and then we'll all be together. And of course, it's all a subterfuge. They all think it's a great idea. They circumcise themselves. They're all recovering from their operation. And Shimon and Levi smash the place to pieces. They kill all the men, including Shechem and Hamor, who are the main participants. They take all the women, they take the children, They despoil the city, they take their property, they lay the whole place to waste. At the end of that story, they come home. Lamed. Look at Lamed at the bottom of number 9. But Yom Yaakov el Shimon ve'el Levi. Yaakov says to Shimon and Levi, Acharetim oti. You've made me stink. Lahavisheni be'yoshev ha'aretz. How can I live in this country now? Look what you've done. How can I deal with anybody anymore? The Kanani, Uba Prizi, the Canaanites and the Prizim, the Animatelis Bara, I'm a small family, the Nesfu Alai, they'll all gather up against me, the Hikuni, and they will hit me, they will beat me. The Nishmadati Ani Ubeiti, and I will be destroyed. Now, what's Yaakov's problem? It's an interesting question. Is it a moral problem, or is it a practical problem? Sounds like a practical problem. It doesn't sound like he has a moral issue, at least he didn't state exactly what the moral issue is. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. We'll see them unfortunately in a minute. But he says, how could you do this? You never even asked me. You never consulted me. You take the law into your own hands. Shimon and Levi were teenagers. You know, this stage. They're young. So how does it end? So it ends. Vayomru. And they responded, Hakazoni yase etachotenu. So they can treat our sister like a zona? Like a prostitute? That's how they should do it. We should just smile? What should we do? What do you expect us to do? They can't treat us like this. And that's the end of the story. Who had the last word? What's the conclusion of the Gemara, of the Chumash? Is Yaakov right or is Shimon HaLevi right? Open question. Yes?
Sorry, the same question. Especially since we see that Yaakov is more of what we presume to be a practical approach, do we see a distinction between combat and non-combat participants in the army?
Participants, you mean soldiers or
yeah.
Victims?
So the medical unit is not going to come charging at you with a knife to kill your soldiers. They're just healing their soldiers.
But well, they will do if they have to. The medical units are trained to kill. Absolutely.
Okay, maybe that's a bad example, but like there's administrators to an army. There's lots of people in an army who will never pick up a gun. But are they still subject to sort of what we've been saying thus far in this idea of, you know, when we're taking action, can we take action against them, even though they're not really...
Even when can they take action against us? Meaning, who they're on our side? They're, or are you talking about people on their side? So you're saying not just civilians, but maybe even the people in their army who are just clerks. You know, they're just filing papers. Are they the same?
Can I bomb military headquarters?
Okay, so there I think you could easily make an argument that, look, an army is an army. People who are drafted into an army are the people who are filing the papers and who are, you know, doing the paychecks are just as much responsible for keeping the army fighting as the people who are firing the guns. In fact, they may be exactly the people who I want to take out. If I can take out the central command, then I can take out the whole army. That's clearly legitimate. Just because this guy happens to be a paper shuffler doesn't make him less central to the effectiveness of the army. Like, you know, who are the most important people in a hospital? How do I close down the hospital most efficiently? The answer is take away the janitors. Take away the janitors within a day, the hospital's closed. You can take away the doctors, they'll find, you know, they can do something else. So it could be that that they're just as guilty in many ways or just as liable. So who has the final word? So if you look over on page 4, so in the end, Yaakov criticizes Shimon and Levi in the brachot, and he curses their anger. And the question is, what's he referring to? And there's a big machlokas you should know in the Parshanot. Is he talking about what they did to Yosef, or what they did to Shechem? The Ramban says he's talking about Shechem because he doesn't know about Yosef. Rashi says he's talking about Yosef because he does know about Yosef. That's not for now. But there are three basic approaches in the Meforshim that I brought you here as to what to do with this in terms of civilians. So one, the Rambam says, you know something? Shimon and Levi were justified. Why? Because the civilians have responsibility for their leaders. They have responsibility to bring their leaders to justice. Therefore, if the civilians didn't bring their leaders to justice, they're just as deserving of death. And he talks about the seven mitzvahs of Noach, that Shechem and Hamor violated the seven mitzvahs of Noach by stealing and raping Dina. Therefore, the people in the town are liable because they should have stopped them. The men, at least. That's the Rambam's position. The Ramban says, no, how can you hold them liable? Absolutely not. Civilians are not liable. There's nothing they can do to replace the leaders. Come on. This is not a democracy. They're not asking the civilians whether they can stay or not. They're local chieftains. The civilians have no choice. Therefore, they were wrong. The Ramban's position is that Shimon and Levi were completely wrong, and they should not have done this. And it was irresponsible. In fact, he says an amazing thing. In the middle source, in number 13, he says, how did he know that these civilians wouldn't do tshuva? Maybe they were genuine. Maybe these people, think about it, these people circumcised themselves to become one with the Jewish people. Maybe that they were like this big crowd that Avraham Avinu, you know, the big Kiruv movement of Avraham and Sarah, the Nefesh HaSe'asu B'charan, all the people they got. Maybe these would have been followers. And you went and you killed them all. That's how you start an outreach movement. I don't think so. So the Ramban says they were completely wrong. The Maharal, and this becomes very relevant, the Maharal, I can't read you the whole source now, the Maharal in number 15 says, you know something? A middle position. The civilians are not liable for what the leaders do. You're right. They can't change the leadership. The civilians are not guilty parties. Not like the Ramban. But, he says, in a war it's different. And this is the critical thing. Have a look, please, in the second paragraph of number 15. Venira, the Loi Kashamidi. It's not a difficult problem at all, says the Maharal. Vishum, the Loi Dami Shnei Umois. Two nations are not the same as two individuals. By the time it gets to Shechem, it's nation versus nation. Ulefikach, hutalahem lilchom. Therefore, they're allowed to kill the nation. Kedin uma sheba lilchom al uma acheret. Because when one country fights another country, like it or not like it, the civilians are part of that country and part of that battle. Every battle in history, look at this, look at the Second World War. The British bombed Germany, the civilians. The Germans bombed Britain. Was that wrong? Was that right? They felt that was the only way they could win the war. The Americans bombed the Japanese. They bombed, and I'm not even just talking about Hiroshima. They firebombed Tokyo night after night after night after night. Far more people died than died in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Was that right? Was that a war crime? Would they do it again? If they had to? Okay, everyone's pointing the finger at us, but how does that work? Because the Maharal, in a situation where nation fights nation, civilian casualties are legitimate. The question is, to what extent are legitimate? How many? How much? When? We'll talk more. Go over the page. David Naval. There's a whole story with David where Naval insults him and he's about to kill everybody. And Abigail stops him and she says to him, "You can't do that. You don't want a guilty to be blood on your hands, even though these people were liable." Abigail stops him at this Yeshua and the Givonim, where they're about to kill the Givonim, and they say, "Well, what about world opinion? It'll be a Chilul Hashem." Remember the story with the Givonim? The Givonim tricked Yeshua and the Jewish people into thinking that they were from a long way away when they were actually local. Therefore, they were deserving. They should have really been part of the killing of the people locally, but then they turned around and the people said, "Look, you know, world opinion, it doesn't matter. Think about the Chilul Hashem. If we kill these people, people aren't going to understand the niceties," and therefore they didn't kill them. Therefore, how do these play into the modern day scenario is a very good question. And they're part of the sources. In terms of practical modern voices, I want to show you a couple of things which I think you'll find interesting. I haven't got much of a voice left, as you can hear, after all the shirim today. But we have got a little bit of time, and I just want to show you what I've got here. First of all, I've actually got a whole cup here. This will get, thank you. I've had so much water, I probably could supply, you know, I'm hydrated to the nth degree. The Netziv in number 22 says that when it comes to the prohibition of murder, okay, it says in the Torah about murder, "Umiyad ha'adam miyad ish achiv et rosh et nefesh ha'adam." If a man kills his brother, I will claim that life from him. You cannot kill people. It says in the Netziv, that's if brothers are killing brothers. But in a war scenario, when there are no brothers anymore, there's a war at stake between them, then the laws of murder don't apply the same way. So again, like the Maharal, we see that there's a different rule for war. The question is, what is that rule going to be? So first of all, you should know that Rav Shapira in number 24 Rav Avram Shapiro, who was the chief rabbi of Israel in the 1980s, early 90s, and also the Rosh Hashiva of Merkaz Arab, he writes very clearly, number 24, Ma din shal uchlusit oyei ezrachit? What is the din of an enemy civilian population that ate milchama in a time of war? Ha'im yesh mitzad ha-din heta lifgo abba? Are we allowed halachically to attack them? Al manak limnoa pegia efsharit, in order to take avoid possible attack, b'chayalei Yisrael, on our soldiers. Okay? So he answers, Tshuva, kol od ein sakana mamashit l'chayaleinu, if there is no real danger to our soldiers, ein heta lifgo b'nefesh af loy b'ruchush, then there is certainly no halachic permissibility to attack any civilian, not even their property. Meaning, the first position has to be that the only heter we can ever give to attack civilians is if there's a legitimate military need. If there's no danger to the soldiers, and the question is, who's going to decide that? We'll see Rav Lichtenstein in a minute talk about that. If there's no danger to the soldiers, you can't touch the enemy civilians. That's clear. Ulam, he says, when there is a clear, definable danger, and again, what does clear danger mean? Clear and present danger, etc. Hari sheyesh litzkor she'al kol moznaim ein omedet rach hayichida lochemet mul achlus yisrael. Then he goes into a whole discussion. He said, it's not just a numbers game. Once there's a legitimate military target, you can kill even the many to save the few. It's not just a number for number, life for life. Once there's a legitimate military target, it's a legitimate military target. I don't have to add up how many people are there to how many people are being saved. It has to be weighed up on others, other issues. There has to be warning. I brought you Pesukim in number 26. Yecheskel says that if a population is warned, Pesukim in Yecheskel, if a population is warned and they don't leave, then they carry some of the responsibility for their own deaths. And by the way, you know, we have to expect that if we're learning it on them, they're going to learn it back on us. You know, we're also a civilian population, we're also attacked. The difference being, and this is what the Israeli army constantly points out, which the world seems to be unwilling to hear, we never attack civilian populations as civilian populations with no military target, whereas we are being attacked as civilian populations with no military target, just to attack civilian populations. There has to be a moral between those two positions, and that has to be played out. Constantly, you hear this on the BBC, constantly, they love this refrain, the cycle of violence. Meaning, they're all as bad as each other. They hit this one, and then they hit this one. How can we break the cycle of violence? It's infuriating that they're not prepared, you know, even on the incitement. You heard Netanyahu the other day with Lisa said from the BBC, where she's saying to Netanyahu, are you prepared to stop the incitement? She says to him, are you prepared to stop the incitement? Talk. He said to him, what planet? He said literally, what planet are you on? Are we on the same planet? He said, you've got to get with the program. He said, what's going on here? I'm the one calling for talks. He's the one inciting violence. And I'm being the one told, call for talks and stop inciting violence. Like, what planet are you on? I don't know, what planet are they on? It's a remarkable thing. A little bit like, you know, can you believe that mobs of people in the Middle Ages would massacre whole towns of Jews because someone told them that they'd stolen the host, you know, the wafer that in the communion, and the Jews were eating the wafers, and thereby killing Jesus all over again. This seems to us to be ridiculous, almost comical, and yet thousands and tens of thousands of people were hacked to pieces in the Rindfleisch massacres because the mobs responded to that. Like, you don't have to tell the truth. You just have to, you know, wind it up. So, the Yecheskel says there has to be warning. Shmuel also, you see this. I want to just point out in number 28, I haven't got time for a lot of questions, there's an interesting response of Rav Amiel, the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, during the Haganah operations. The Haganah in the 1930s had a policy of what they called havlaga, restraint. And they said, we're not killing Arabs because of our policy of havlaga, restraint. And Rav Amiel got very upset with them and said, what do you mean you're not killing Arabs because of your policy of havlaga? says, you're not killing Arabs because you're not allowed to murder people. That's why you're not killing Arabs, not because of your policy. Implication being, if your policy changed, you'd be allowed to murder people. He has some very strong comments to say. Look at what he said here. Look at what he says in number 28 in the middle. Let's go start from the beginning. Choshveni haba ma'amrim haniskaran la'el midvarim ba'adam. Okay? She'amnam hineni mitnaged la'ashem havlaga. I object to the term restraint. She'zehu mashma ki'ilu kol isa shal shvich adamim. That implies that the only reason you're not murdering people, shal aravim, the Arabs, who rak mitzad havlaga, is only because of your policy of restraint. Ba'od she'be'emek, but really, ze'asul lanu mitzad halut titzach. It's also to murder people. The Yerida Musarit, he me'ein dug matah. There's no greater moral corruption, he says. If we try to justify murdering people, just on the basis of utility, and he says now a very strong thing. In my view, even if we were to know the birur for sure, that through these killings, we would get the full geula, we would get the Beit HaMikdash. We should push that ge'ula away. We don't want a ge'ula based on murdering people. The law of not only that, even if we can capture some murderers, some Arab terrorists, even if we have a doubt, one in a thousand, that amongst these murderers, maybe there's an innocent person, we can't touch them in case we kill innocent people. How do you fit that in? So many of the more recent commentators, they take this tshuva of Amiel and they say, okay, look, this is very strong the other way. There has to be a strong musari, there has to be a strong ethic. We're not allowed to murder human beings. Arabs are human beings. You can murder people if there's a need, but you can't murder people who are innocent. So, it could be that this is in a civilian scenario. The Haganah was not nation versus nation. But in a nation versus nation, it's different. Which then raises the question, what are we dealing with today? Civilians or a nation? And this asymmetric warfare makes it impossible to say, which is very difficult. I want to just talk about two last things. I don't want to take you late. I'll answer questions at the end. I want to just point out two pieces at the very end. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, in number 33, who was the Rosh Shiva of Gush, of Har Etzion, who passed away last year, he makes a number of points. And he says, I'll summarize what he says in number 33. He says, look, there are costs to war. There are costs on our side, but there are also costs on their side. And we cannot just ignore the proportionality. We can't just ignore that. We can't say that any number of enemy civilians are worthwhile to save one soldier. So we can't say that. He doesn't tell you where that line should be, but he says we can't say that, whereas others do at least imply that. And he says on the other page, he says a very beautiful thing. He says that we can't just hide behind technocrats and say the army know what they're doing. He says, obviously you can't question the army. We have to support the army. He says, but the civilian population has an obligation to make sure that the army is following a moral and ethical standard. Which, Baruch Hashem, I think, the Israeli army does. But he said, that's not something we can just ignore. We have to fight their lack of ethic with ethic. We don't fight their anger with love. We fight their non-ethic with ethic. And therefore, that has to be a thought. And he says, a soldier mustn't think, when he leaves civilian life and enters the army, that he's leaving the ethical zone into a non-ethical, into an everything-goes zone. That's not how it works. Again, where you draw those lines is a good question, but he's very insistent that there has to be some kind of an analysis of that. Rav Dov Lior in number 34 has a much more broader approach, much more quote unquote right wing, and basically says, look, there is a room for compassion in war. The compassion is we give them an opportunity to make peace. Once that's been ignored, the compassion is focused on our people. You know, if there's a pecking order of compassion on our people, on our soldiers versus their civilians, why should our compassion for their civilians be higher than our compassion for our soldiers? Which is a good question. And he deals with this at length. I advise you to look at this. It's very, very interesting. Let me leave you with two quotes. And I'm conscious of the fact that I've done this very quickly, but this is the time we have. I finish with two quotes which if you like, are coming from the opposite poles. Number 36 is Professor Asik Kasha, who is the an ethicist, professor of philosophy, who is the author of the IDS Ethical Code of Conduct, which is not coming from a religious, specifically religious place, who writes, "We have no moral obligation to risk the life of our soldiers in the context of military operations of self-defense against the enemy." We don't have to risk our soldiers. We have no moral obligation to save civilians in order to thereby risk our soldiers. By the same token, Rav Shlomo Gorenz, often associated very much with the right, the religious rights, he ends here, number 37, "Human life is undoubtedly a supreme value in Judaism as expressed both in the halakha and the prophetic ethic. This refers not only to Jews, but to all men created in the image of God. We see that God has compassion for the life of idolaters, finds it difficult to destroy them. Since we are enjoined to imitate the moral qualities of God, we too should not rejoice over the destruction of the enemies of Israel," which is where we came in at the beginning. We don't avoid our responsibility to kill where we have to kill. And we don't even feel that turns us into killers, because that killing has to be done, and it's a milchamit mitzvah. It doesn't mean it's a mitzvah to be killing, it's a war for the purposes of mitzvah. But we don't hand out candies in the street, and we don't rejoice, and we don't shoot guns in the air, and we don't behave like animals. We kill where we have to kill. And that's the difference, and that's how we fight fire with the opposite. Okay? We don't face hate with compassion and love, because we'll just end up being destroyed. But we do fight non-ethic with ethic, and we kill where we have to kill, but we think about it hard. And we don't always call it right. But you know something? Not always calling it right, but calling it right sometimes, is better than the alternative, which is what we see against us, which is not caring one way or the other. Alright, we'll leave it there. There's so much more to say, but that's all we have time for right now. Look at the sheet more, and look at the reading list more. There's lots to talk about.